Welcome to this week's Behind the Headlines podcast. I'm your host, Katie O'Connell, back from vacation. Many thanks to Matt Montgomery for filling in for me last week. Coming up in today's show, our books editor previews Harper Lee's new novel, and we'll journey through Wisconsin's driftless region, sampling beer along the way. The finalized state budget dominated headlines this week. Governor Scott Walker will sign the budget Sunday. He's also announcing his candidacy for the 2016 presidential campaign on Monday. Here's editor Greg Borowski and reporter Craig Gilbert. The two discuss Scott Walker's upcoming announcement and campaign during this week's JS on Politics show.
We're joined now by Washington Bureau Chief Craig Gilbert to talk about Governor Scott Walker's impending announcement this coming Monday, his formal rollout of his presidential campaign. So, Craig, if we rolled back the clock 3 years, we would have been right in the midst of this recall, something that no other governor in the country had ever survived. How do we get from there to here for Scott Walker, where he's a very top-tier presidential contender?
Well, the recall has really turned out to be his great stepping stone to national politics. In fact, it's almost impossible to imagine him making this run for president without the recall. I mean, on lots of levels, it obviously brought him a donor base, it put him on the national map, and it kind of gave him a built-in message for Republican primary voters. In fact, his bumper sticker slogan right now, which is that I'm a fighter and a winner, and you get both with me, is really unthinkable without the recall. The recall is his, you know, great credential when it comes to winning political victories, and it's also his great credential when it comes to speaking to conservatives who want somebody who's going to fight for the things they really care about. So it's really the backbone of his campaign, and his campaign is looking, views the recall as helping him communicate to Republican voters on all sorts of levels.
So on Monday, Governor Walker will be joining an ever-expanding field of Republican contenders. It's up somewhere in the 16 or 17 range now. Craig, does that size of a field, do you feel, help the governor or hurt the governor as he tries to distinguish himself among the other contenders?
Well, in one sense, it's easy for him to set himself apart in a big field because he is a governor. There aren't too many of those, and he has been through this unique kind of political history with the recall. On the other hand, you can see how having to compete with all these different candidates could be a problem for him, because one of his political strengths is that the polls show he can appeal across party lines. He can appeal to the establishment, he can appeal to the Tea Party, to evangelicals. And the bigger the field, the more Republicans he's competing with for each one of these groups of voters. So he's really competing with some candidates to the right of him and some candidates to the left of him. And he's trying to sort of find this sweet spot. But the danger for him is just kind of having to fight all these battles on different fronts at once.
All right. So let's look at sort of two lenses to this campaign. What our readers and viewers are seeing primarily is what's happening in Wisconsin, and that coverage is things like the governor's gone, the budget was difficult to get through, the open records issue that was just in the news. How is he being perceived at the national level, though? So people who are getting that national filter, how do you feel he's faring?
Well, I think you're going to see when he makes his announcement on Monday, he's going to be lavished with national attention, and that's primarily because within the national political community, he's regarded as one of three or possibly four Republican candidates who are most likely to get the nomination in the end. I mean, the others in that group would certainly include Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio and maybe one or two others. But he has that, you know, stature now within the Republican field. I think the jury is still out from a national perspective on how well he'll perform as a candidate. Everybody has to sort of take their game to a new level when they're running for president. He's had some speed bumps and some hiccups along the way. People are still waiting to see kind of how he does as a candidate and whether he can kind of rise to that level. But again, I mean, he has the stature right now within the political community of being seen in the front rank of viable Republican candidates.
All right, so last question here, thinking ahead to the governor's speech on Monday evening, if you had one thing, if you said, wrote down a one note card for Governor Walker, this is the one thing you have to accomplish, what do you think that is for him on Monday?
Well, I think he has to show that he can be presidential. I think if you think about anyone who's running as governor, he's already shown that he can deliver a good speech. I think that was shown back in Iowa, and he sort of checked that box. But when you were governor of a modest-sized Midwestern state running for president, I mean, you have to show that you're sort of big enough personally big enough for the job, and so I think he needs to project that on Monday.
All right, we'll be back next week, and we can make that assessment of how the governor did. Thanks, Craig.
You're welcome.
Greg also talked to two of our PolitiFact reporters about Walker's Truthometer ratings. We'll have that later in the show. The countdown until the release of Harper Lee's novel continues. Ghost at a Watchman lands in stores on Tuesday. What can readers expect from this novel? Will the book have the same cultural importance as To Kill a Mockingbird? Reporter Marion Reynaud found out.
So I'm sitting with Jim Higgins, our books editor, to talk about one of 2015's most anticipated publications. It's called Ghost at a Watchman, and it was written by Harper Lee prior to her novel To Kill a Mockingbird. Its first chapter was published Friday. Jim, have you had the chance to read that first chapter yet?
I did, and I found it interesting. The first chapter takes some of the characters from To Kill a Mockingbird, especially Jean Louise, who's called Finch in Mockingbird, and now she's about 30 years old, and she's on a train returning home to see her elderly father and visit her hometown. It's impossible not to read that first chapter without thinking of those the younger versions of those characters in Mockingbird.
Yeah. And what do you think readers can expect just based on what you've been able to read?
From what I've led to believe from the publicity material for this book, readers can expect some kind of conflict or confrontation or meeting of the minds between Jean Louise and her father, Atticus, who's the heroic lawyer in Mockingbird. This newer book takes place in the mid-1950s and certainly a time of turbulence in America, and the racism that was exposed in Mockingbird, you know, hasn't gone away by the 1950s, and Jean Louise represents a different generation than her father.
And there's been a 55-year gap since that book was published. Did we know why all this time has passed by?
We don't. That's a tantalizing story, and there have been no direct statements by the author, who's 89 and living in an Alabama assisted living facility. Don't even statements attributed to her through her publisher and other people. She has said many times that all the attention and publicity she received after the Mockingbird and the success of the movie just really threw her off balance. And while no one could call her a Salinger kind of recluse, she certainly was a very private person who guarded her privacy, gave very few interviews. None of this still accounts for what happened to that manuscript. And her lawyer and agent has said she found it last year in a safe deposit box with the new manuscript Watchmen in a safe deposit box. A New York Times story questioned that and seems to indicate that someone else may have seen this a couple years ago, but there's really no satisfactory answer as to where it's been all these years. I know if I'd written a book, I don't think I'd lose where it was for 50 years, but we don't have an answer right now.
And when it was published, To Kill a Mockingbird was culturally important. I mean, do you think that there'll be the same sort of significance with this novel?
I can't see it having the impact of Mockingbird. Mockingbird, I think, is a once-in-a-lifetime kind of book and moment. And it's really hard to extrapolate from one chapter, but I think we'll see an interesting but fairly ordinary family novel.
And have you talked to local booksellers about buzz leading up to the book's publication on Tuesday?
Daniel Golden, who's the owner of Boswell Books on Downer Avenue, has said it's the biggest buzz book for the store since Dan Brown's sequel to The Da Vinci Code. So that's in about the last 3 or 4 years. He would say that it's not quite at Harry Potter level. I mean, in our lifetime, those were the buzz books, the Harry Potter books. But Daniel said there's a strong amount of interest, and there have been about 40 holds on a book so far, which is, for a small store like his, that's a good number. And the three local Barnes & Noble stores are all planning a day of special events Monday. So there's excitement. Not end-of-the-world excitement, but excitement.
And do you think that the excitement for the book comes more from the fact that it's Harper Lee's or from the gap in time? Or what do you think people are excited about?
I think people love these characters and the story so much. I mean, you know, when it's more common today, but whether in books or TV or movies, when we like something, we're fans. We want the experience. This is a very fanish phenomenon. We want the experience to continue. And really inadvertently, this isn't a sequel that Harper Lee wrote after Mockingbird to cash in. Just happens to be the same characters older, but that will appeal to all of us who don't want a story we like to end. We want it to keep going, and somehow we're getting our wish here.
And are there any other American classics or favorites of yours that you would love to see a random surprise sequel to or prequel to?
Oh, is that a good question? And now I don't have an immediate answer. Let me think about this a minute. The first two that come to mind are a Huckleberry Finn sequel would be a fascinating book, and this will date me, Marianne, but a Catch-22 sequel.
For all those interested in picking up a copy of the book, it comes out on Tuesday. You can find Jim's story in the Sunday edition of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel or online at tapmilwaukee.com. In business news, bankruptcy filings hit a 7-year low in eastern Wisconsin. The filings recorded from January through June mark the first time that period has had fewer than 8,000 filings since 2008. About 72% of the filings were Chapter 7 bankruptcies. Those wipe out financial obligations such as medical bills, utility debt, and credit card balances. Last-minute additions to the state budget would allow 7-day work weeks. The provisions for a living wage would be struck down from the state statutes as well. That would nullify a lawsuit filed by Wisconsin workers that aims to raise the minimum wage. Also in the budget, chiropractors would be given an exclusive right under a provision added last week. Chiropractors could have complaints against health insurers heard by a retired judge. Health insurers would be required to pay the cost of the proceedings, no matter the outcome, as well. Health insurance trade groups and business trade groups opposed the provision. And the Milwaukee Bucks reiterated their need for a new arena this week. The team's president told lawmakers that without the new $500 million arena, the National Basketball Association will force the sale of the team. Republican legislators have removed arena funding from the state budget and are seeking to pass it as separate legislation. For more business headlines, pick up the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel or visit jsonline.com/business. Although he's been making moves for a few months, Governor Scott Walker is set to announce his presidential bid Monday. As promised, here's a look at his PolitiFact ratings.
I'm joined now by Dave Umhafer and Tom Kircher, two of our PolitiFact Wisconsin reporters, and we're going to take a look at how the governor has fared on the truth meter. So, first of all, one number is 144. We've done 144 ratings on Governor Walker. Dave, why have there been so darn many on him?
Well, first and foremost, I mean, reader demand for items on the governor is off the charts. He's at the center of the state political scene, the budget, and now, you know, certainly over the last year, he's become a true national figure, has been aggressively running for president unofficially, and, he just figures so prominently into our philosophy of wanting to look at timely and topical items.
All right, and Tom, just remind our readers, what are we looking for when we take a statement? What makes it appealing for us to fact check?
We're always looking for statements that make us stop and say, really, is that true? Something that's topical, something that makes a strong claim of in a factual way. And the fact that it's made by Scott Walker tends to raise a level of interest even more because of passion on both sides,
right,
for and against
him. And we've done, of course, many statements of Democrats about Scott Walker, so there's a whole range of things we've done. But let's start with some of these Scott Walker ones to look at, and we'll start with this statement. Hillary Clinton's rejection of efforts to make it easier to vote and harder to cheat not only defies logic, but the will of the majority of Americans. We rated that mostly true. Dave, tell us why.
Polls do show a strong bipartisan support for voter ID, and it's right to say that IDs make it harder to cheat in some cases, but he was off in saying that it makes it easier to vote.
Right, and that was a little back and forth those two had about voter access.
Yep.
Right, so this one is for Tom. This is Scott Walker saying that Barack Obama told the U.S. Coast Guard Academy that the number one threat to the military and the world today is global warming, and that one we rated mostly false. Talk about
and,
it.
The president on many occasions has said climate change, there's no greater threat to the world than climate change. But in the speech to the Coast Guard graduates that the governor cites, Obama described climate change as a serious threat, but not number one.
Okay. This was one that Scott Walker made talking about the unemployment rate, and it, bear with me because it's kind of long. Nationally, the unemployment rate for veterans is far greater than the national unemployment rate. And in Wisconsin, one of those rare examples where unemployment is actually lower for veterans than it is for the population as a whole, and certainly lower than it is nationally. Maybe if that's a talking point, he's got to tighten it up. But Dave, we read that half true.
We got to tighten it up. Yeah. That's a mouthful for sure. In many states, including Wisconsin, veterans are less likely to be unemployed. At the same time, our veterans do much better than the national average. So it was kind of a
Mixed bag.
Right.
All right, so here's one. Scott Walker's saying, my support from young voters, those 18 to 24, in November of 2014 was, quote, largely unheard of for a Republican. We rated that half true. Tom?
And this, of course, is when the governor ran for re-election and defeated Mary Burke. There were three other Republicans around the country who ran for governor. What we found is that Walker did better than two of them among voters 18 to 24, but the third governor did better than Walker did.
All right, so we're running through claims from that Governor Scott Walker has made in anticipation of his announcement. You can find them all at politifactwisconsin.com/Scott Walker.
That audio came to us from our JSN Politics show. You can watch the full show online at jsonline.com/politics. The show is also available as a podcast. You can find that on iTunes and Stitcher Radio. If you're interested in either the budget signing or Walker's campaign announcement, visit jsonline.com or follow us on Twitter and Facebook. We'll have updates throughout the day on Sunday and Monday during those events. Have you seen the rolling hills in Wisconsin's Driftless region or sampled the brews out there? Two of our staffers did just that.
I'm Chelsea Lewis, and I'm the editor of Wisconsin Trails, our online travel and outdoors website.
I'm Kathy Flanagan. I'm a general assignment feature writer, and I also write about craft beer.
What made you decide to go out to the Driftless region for this story?
Well, I think we were kind of just looking at different areas in the state that have a concentration of breweries, and honestly, in a state like Wisconsin, that's pretty much everywhere. But I think one thing that really drew us to the Driftless region was, one, just how beautiful it is. It's a really gorgeous area of the state. You know, the glaciers didn't make their way there, so it's very hilly, rural. You get these beautiful rolling countryside.
We wanted someplace purdy.
Yeah, definitely. And it's an area not a lot of people go to, I think. You know, a lot of people go to Door County or up north or Madison, and the Driftless region sometimes gets overlooked.
We wanted something that we could do in 4 days or less, that we could make mini trips if people wanted to go one day, go somewhere, come back, so that the geography worked out.
How much planning did it take?
Not that much. Seriously, you could do it on, you could decide on Monday that you want to go on a weekend.
Yeah, and I think that's what's nice about it, too. We planned some things. You know, we planned a couple of places to stay, but then we kind of just winged it. And, for example, in New Glarus, we didn't have a place to stay. We kind of rolled in, found a nice little hotel motel to stay at. And I think that's some of the fun of a trip like this, is just kind of exploring and finding cool places to stop along the way. Planning is important. I'm a big planner, but you got to leave a little room for spontaneity.
Kathy, as the beer writer, what was your favorite brew you had when you were out there?
New Glarus. Their beers are good. They're solid. They're wonderful beers. I always like Moon Man, and so I had that. I wish now that I had purchased more of their R&D 2014 vintage, because mine are all gone. And that's a really good beer.
And Chelsea, as the travel writer, what was your favorite site you saw there or favorite part of exploring that area?
Oh, that's difficult. Potosi was really cool, not only because it was beautiful, but it has a really cool story. You know, this really small town of around 700 people, they kind of rallied together to save this historic brewery in their town. They raised, through grants and fundraising and other things, $7 million to rebuild their brewery there. And now they're expanding even more. So it's kind of a nice story about a community coming together to do something good. And now they draw like 70,000 tourists there every year. So it's just a really cool story. Small town Wisconsin doing something big. That really interests me.
And the village president took us around. I mean, really, we felt like royalty.
Yeah, he was really nice. So that's another thing, too, just the people you meet along the way.
Yeah.
How is the brewery scene throughout Wisconsin different than what people might know in Madison or Milwaukee?
I think in Madison, the craft breweries are really concentrated, and they're exploding, and they're exploding here as well. But some of the breweries that we went to have been, they're among the oldest in the state, and they're getting some kind of revival in one way or another. Minhas is doing a lot of contract brewing for Trader Joe's or Costco, and it's sort of a good thing for the city to have that there. And if you want to learn interesting history that includes kidnapping and how the Huber Law came into place, you should go on a Minhas tour. Same with what Chelsea just said about Potosi. I mean, it's the salvation for the town in a lot of ways after manufacturing jobs moved to Iowa and then were dropped there during the recession. So, you know, it's interesting.
Yeah, and I think a lot of these places, because they are in more rural areas, you know, Madison and Milwaukee have the advantage of a dedicated, interested craft beer following in their own cities. But these towns are so small that they depend on attracting people from elsewhere. And so they've kind of made themselves into destinations. You know, Potosi has the National Brewery Museum. They have their own little brew pub with a cute little beer garden. Minhas, like Kathy said, has a really interesting tour. And Minhas is in Monroe, which is kind of the cheese capital with, you know, their stinky cheese, Limburger cheese.
And Baumgartner's, where they throw quarters on the ceiling or throw dollars on the ceiling, make them stick. And just, you know, it's quaint, but it has purpose. The beer has purpose there. It defines the community. It does in New Glarus, too. I mean,
definitely.
That's how the whole community came together and developed almost a theme, you know, the Swiss theme, but New Glarus adds to it with beer that draws people in because you can't get it anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
Kathy and Chelsea said they're not sure where they're heading next. There's a chance they could swing by the growing brewing scene in Green Bay. We'll stay tuned for that story. To start planning your trip to the Driftless region, find their story online at tapmilwaukee.com. And in the world of sports, we're delving into the IndyCar series at the Milwaukee Mile. Here's Matt Montgomery with more.
I'm joined by motorsports writer Dave Kallman to talk about the IndyCar series at Milwaukee Mile. Dave, what are the biggest storylines heading into this race?
This is always a great race for the series in terms of, you know, there's just a lot of opportunity for passing. Guys are in traffic. Leaders are in traffic very quickly. It's a fast track that's really pretty short. So there's a lot of action all the time. I would say that last year, Will Power went on to win the championship after winning Milwaukee. So it was a kind of a stepping stone, important stop for him. So it was, he kind of dominated, and that's not uncommon. But then there's still always it's not uncommon that someone leads a bunch, but there's always, behind that, there's always a ton of activity. So, you know, you see those numbers sometimes, they look a little skewed, but it's a great place for racing. As far as who might be the guys to watch, certainly Will, after last year, if they can just pick up where they left off, that's they'll be really, really tough. And his teammate Juan Pablo Montoya won at the Mile in 2000, long, long time ago. And you know, he was there, right? He was there last year, second place finisher, has led this championship from the start all the way till now. So he's another one of those guys you'd look for. There's a Honda Chevy battle that so far Chevy's had the upper hand, but maybe this is where Honda gets things moving. There's the Andretti. You get an Andretti-Rahal rivalry, the next generation, that's also got some potential. And Graham Rahal was the winner of the most recent race in California a couple weeks ago, and Marco's been on the front row here a couple times. So there's a lot going on out there. It's a really compact Sunday with practice and qualifying and the race all on the same day, which is new. So it'll be kind of interesting to see how that plays out from a competitive standpoint, but also you know, what fans make of that. You could sit in your seat for what, 12 hours or something if you wanted to. So there'll be a lot going on.
Taking a step back, what's the status of racing in Wisconsin, and how do you see it going forward?
These have been tough times for racing the last maybe decade or so, just because it's such a money-driven sport. It's sponsorship is so important. It's an expensive sport, so it's been tough in general. Especially since what 2007-08, the financial troubles. But Wisconsin seems to be ahead of most places around the country in terms of, you know, the short tracks, the little local grassroots stuff, being able to weather some of the storms, and we still, you know, still have major racing here as well. So it's a nice cross section. You know, you have places like Slinger Speedway and a couple of racetracks in Beaver Dam and a dirt track down in Wilmot, a drag strip in Union Grove. Got one of the world's greatest road courses that's truly a hidden gem in Ishbeam County in Elkhart Lake, Road America. So the from a short track standpoint, you know, like I say, it's tough. There's tracks closing, but Wisconsin has done the ones in Wisconsin are doing as well as any in the industry probably as far as weathering that stuff. And they put on some great racing and have some truly dedicated fans, but you know, of course, there's always room for new ones, and everybody's looking to bring on the next generation. You know, take the kids, that sort of thing. You know, the mile, it's tricky. It's a tough thing to do. Crowds haven't been maybe what people would like the last few years, but again, it is a great place for racing, and there's hope that IndyCar will continue on here. There's hope that IndyCar will go to Road America next year, that not necessarily connected to whether they stay at the mile, but you know, it's a possible addition. Road America's got Sports Car Weekend coming up in August. That's very popular, and they also have the NASCAR Xfinity Series, the second division there, and that's on an off weekend for the Sprint Cups. You know, it's off weekend for the big guys, so there might be a few names that might make it to Road America that ordinarily wouldn't or couldn't have in the past. So, I guess racing in Wisconsin is as strong as you'll find it anywhere, and as competitive as you'll find it anywhere, and probably just about as diverse. So it's good. I mean, it's again, the industry as a whole is a little tricky, but as Wisconsin fits into that, I think we're right up there. So there's plenty to do and see if you're interested, or if you're not sure you're interested, there are all sorts of opportunities to check it out and learn a little bit about it.
All right, thank you very much, Dave. Once again, I was joined by motorsports writer Dave Kallman. You can find his writing in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and at jsonline.com/autoracing. And you can also follow him on Twitter at Dave Kallman. Dave, once again, thanks for your time.
My pleasure.
Well, that's it for this week's show. I hope you've enjoyed it. Have a great week and tune in next Sunday as we explore Governor Scott Walker's campaign and the related headlines.